Hi. Thanks for joining me tonight on Books Plus, RN's 3 hours of fiction, authors, readings and critique. I'm Kate Evans and tonight we're revisiting old stories, remaking them or rediscovering or wondering what happened next. From Treasure Island to the doomed Princes in the Tower, Peter Pan and a cache of 19th century fairy tales lost in a German archive. While after 8 in the Books Plus book reading omnibus, the lost and revisited stories are defined by music, in this case Bach, in the reading of Dutch novelist Anne Enquist's Counterpoint. But we begin with the black spot, Pieces of Eight, and the archetypal swashbuckling sea adventure, Treasure Island. Well, archetypal as long as you don't count Captain Hook, but we'll get to him later in the hour, at about 7:40. But back to Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Imagine the boy, Jim Hawkins, grown up and running a tavern, drinking too much and endlessly telling and retelling his adventures aboard the Hispaniola. Now imagine Long John Silver, living on to an ancient age and with a daughter, Natty. That's what poet, novelist, biographer and former poet laureate Sir Andrew Motion has done. It's a clever novel, called Silver, that takes us places Stevenson couldn't. It adds in the politics of the sea, but keeps its mystery and poetry. Andrew Motion spoke to Michael Cathcart for Books and Arts Daily, and they began talking about the flotsam and jetsam that has to be picked up or discarded to continue a tale such as this.
One of the things that I was very keen to do was to recognise that, I mean, without actually spelling it out, that the road to literary damnation is probably paved with bad sequels and prequels, and the reason that they fail when they do fail, usually, is that they take on the original at its own game too precisely, and thereby enter into a competition they're going to lose. So I thought, casting my mind around the sequels and prequels that work, and thinking, for instance, about Tom Toppard's play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which gives us a very interesting take on the Hamlet story, or Jean Rhys's wonderful novel Wide Sargasso Sea, which is about the first Mrs. Rochester in Jane Eyre, that they gave me a kind of pointer, which is to say that if I took a big step away from the original book, I would solve this problem of competing with something that I was likely to lose in competition with, and thereby to create something that was a sort of homage and certainly respectful towards it, but that stood at a significant distance from it by moving the whole story on a generation, as you said. So that both meant, I mean, to answer your question more precisely, it both meant that I needed to have a knowledge of the original book of Treasure Island itself running throughout my own, but also feel that I could, as I say, stand at a significant distance from it and write something that was mine and mine alone.
You know, I keep reading that you've absorbed Stevenson's tone and his storytelling style, but that doesn't seem to me to be quite right. I mean,
it doesn't feel like
Stevenson to me at all. It feels like the next generation. I mean,
that's exactly right. I mean, I was very careful with myself not to take on Stevenson, as I've already said, and it is, as you reminded people now, 1802 in terms of the narrative. We don't know precisely when Treasure Island is set. Stevenson says 17 blank blank, but there are Stevenson anoraks, of which there are a large number, and why shouldn't there be, reckon it's sort of early 1760s. Now, crucially for me, that means that Treasure Island is a pre-Enlightenment story. It's pre-French Revolution. It's the bad old world, if you like, where people have a different idea of democracy, a different idea of the self, all that sort of stuff. And that my kids, when they go back, are full of Enlightenment idealism. They think the world is better. They think they know things their parents don't. They think all parrots belong in history books, or were probably exaggerated in the first place. But when they get to the island, they find that dreadful things are happening there. So their kind of moral problem, if you like, is how to reconcile their sense of newness with their sense that the bad old world hasn't entirely gone away and has to be negotiated.
Yes, they're children of the generation that opposed the slave trade, for example.
For instance. I mean, that's crucial to my story. Also, I hope important to it is the way that Jim is beginning to be aware of things in nature in a new way. I mean, if you think that the romantic poet John Clare was publishing in the 1820s, but a child in the early 1800s, I rather had him in mind for Jim as somebody who is seeing the world in the same sort of way that Jim is, paying attention to little things in nature and feeling a sort of kinship with the natural world that we, of course, want to put an environmental spin on these days, but at the beginning of the 1800s was a new and important thing, a romantic preoccupation.
Andrew, can we just tell the listener a little bit of the story without giving it away?
Sure,
otherwise,
sure.
They won't know what we're talking about.
No, what on earth we're talking about.
Yes. So the story is that young Jim is there in the inn when this girl Nettie shows up,
yeah,
and persuades him to come on an adventure.
Yes, well, in Treasure Island itself, Stevenson gives you a wonderful sense of having a complete experience as you read the book, but he leaves open various doors and windows. He was a person who was interested in sequels himself. Indeed, he wrote a sequel to Kidnapped, as I'm sure you recall, a book called Katrina, which, having said that, not many people read these days, but there it is, and it's proof, as I say, of his interest in these things. In Treasure Island, he leaves all the silver on the island. They take away all the golden bits and bobs, but they leave the silver behind. Long John Silver escapes at the end, as you may recall. He literally hops off, perhaps to hook up with his wife, who's mentioned two or three times very glancingly in the original book, a woman of colour, Stevenson describes her as. So presumably somebody that he met in the Caribbean on some earlier trip. And also, as the Hispaniola, their boat sails away over the curve of the world, it leaves behind three maroons, Stevenson calls them, three really malevolent pirates. So you finish the book wondering what on earth is in store for them, what happened to them. So I thought, I took those three as my main triggers. So as you say, the kids who are now 18, Natty Silver and Jim Hawkins too. Natty is commissioned by her father, who's a vastly old, cobwebby man now, effectively to seduce Jim, to persuade him at least, to steal the map from his father's chest, which was originally Billy Bones's chest, because he, Mr. Silver, has commissioned a boat, not full of wicked pirates, but full of good men, because he needs to rely on them, to go to the island, get the silver, and come back with it to England so that he can have, in a word that the book would never dream of using, closure. He wants to finish the story. But as I say, when they get to the island, so all that all happens, and when they get to the island, expecting there to be, you know, at worst, three skeletons of the marooned people there, they find that, and I think this, I can say this without giving away too much, that the island has been crashed into by a slave ship, and the three maroons have re-enslaved the slaves, and with the help of the slaves' original guards, they're running a kind of Joseph Conrad dystopia, a nightmare state. So the kids have the scales torn from their eyes, and they have to work out how to, or indeed whether, to get the silver at all, or whether their main obligation is to free the slaves and sort that out.
And one of the things that you do in this book is that you face the consequences of human violence rather than being complicit in the grim entertainment of things like walking the plank.
Sure.
We actually look into the face of the horror of it.
I hope so. I mean, that's very interesting you say that, because I think there are two streams of influence that come out of Treasure Island, really. One is, oh, Pirates of the Caribbean and all that sort of jolly jape type stuff. Pirates who are essentially comic characters. Pirates who appear in pantomimes and so on and so forth. And the other stream, which is the other face of Long John Silver, if you like, in the original, is real menace, real malevolence. And it is worth bearing in mind, I think, that when we open the newspapers these days and see the word pirates, when it's not a review of Johnny Depp, what we're talking about is Somalia.
Mm.
You know? I mean, piracy is essentially a profoundly serious and repellent thing. And I did want some of the real menace of that I think is latent in the original, and sometimes more than latent. But I wanted to emphasize that, not to turn the book into a kind of, you know, gore fest, but just to say that this is a book about serious things.
Yes, and I want to emphasize too to the reader that it's hugely entertaining.
Well, good, I'm glad it is.
I mean, it is a jolly romp. It's just that the consequences of the romp are quite serious. And when our heroine looks as though she's going to meet a very unpleasant end,
yes,
you are looking at terrible cruelty. But then the way in which she escapes comes purely out of fantasy.
Yeah, it comes out of fantasy, exactly. Well, that's the sort of marriage that I wanted to make in the book, if you like, between I wanted to write a story which would keep people turning the pages and feel they were getting kind of jolly yarn, exciting and page-turning and all that sort of stuff. But I wanted them to close it thinking, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is about greed and a colonial moment and a complicated relationship between a son and his father, guilt of one kind or another, colonial guilt, personal guilt, and also, of course, about coming of age. I mean, these kids are 18. Jim, my Jim, is pretty wet behind the ears still in all sorts of ways. But Natty has a complicated history. She obviously has a rather complicated relationship with her father. I think I can say that without offending too many listeners and giving too much away. We don't hear about that in much detail, but we know that she is, in a sort of bad sense of the word, an experienced young woman. And that means that Jim's relationship with her is in turn complicated because something inside her is frozen. He falls in love with her really during the course of the book, but can she love him back? Well, we'll see.
Mm. Now, you say that the secret engine of Stevenson's books is the complex relationship that he had with his father.
I do think that. I mean, if you just pass Kidnapped, especially through your mind, you immediately see that. But if you think about fathers and father figures in Treasure Island, Jim's father, I mean, the original Jim's father, has to die early in order for Jim to have his adventure, in order for the book to come into existence, if you like. But there is something very complicatedly, some of the time, fatherly about the relationship, or about Long John Silver himself, about the relationship between Long John Silver and the original Jim. Long John Silver is like one of those things that you pull out of the cereal packet, that if you look at it in one way, it shows you one thing, and you tilt it a bit, and it looks like something else. In a certain light, he's amusing, responsible, reliable, brave, enterprising, clever, with that great big face like a ham, Stevenson says that he has. And looked at from another angle, he's entirely unreliable, he's duplicitous, he's wicked, he's a murderer. You absolutely wouldn't rely on him to get you through anything, still less to get you home after an adventure on Treasure Island. So I think we, as I say, we do need really to experience the menace of the figure in order to see the book in a rounded way.
Were you thinking about your own relationship with your own dad? Because I know he died.
I was. He did. Well, my life, it's very nice of you to allow me to say this, my life changed in very profound ways in the lead up to beginning to write this book. My father died. I love my father, and I don't want to make out as though there's a sort of secret misery memoir going on in this book. There isn't. I mean, it wasn't like that. But my father was he was a rather severe and remote figure. So we never said to each other most of the things that dads and their children ought to say to one another. So I was working out something about I still am working out something about my feelings for him as I set off into the book. I just stood down as laureate. And although I was very proud to do that and proud of a lot of the things that I did during that decade that I did it, I nevertheless, as I stood down, felt a huge sense of burden sliding off my shoulders, and a kind of spring came into my step that I'd forgotten I even had, really. And I got married again after a period of living more or less by myself, and we moved house. So just about everything in my life was thrown into the air and came down in a new shape.
And fell down in a better shape.
Well, I mean, with no disrespect implied to things in my earlier life, I have to say, in all sorts of ways, yes. I mean, I became happy after quite a long time of unhappiness, and felt I was riding a kind of wave of opportunity that isn't often given to people as they're staring down 60, which I was and am. So I felt incredibly blessed in all those sorts of ways. And it seemed right and proper, really, to take on the writing of a book that I'd thought about for a very long time, with a spirit of, as I say, responsibility to the original and a new kind of freedom, a kind of writerly excitement that I hadn't felt for a long time. If I was ever going to write the book, I was going to do it then.
Does that explain why you end the book as a kind of moral fable? I mean, a storm appears, and like Birnam Wood coming to Dunsinane, nature puts the world to rights.
Yes, well, it wipes the slate, doesn't it? But, of course, a lot of people have to die for that to happen. I mean, again, I shouldn't say too much about this, because otherwise I'll give it all away. But at the end of it, there is this very bad shipwreck, storm and shipwreck, and there are a lot of casualties. That is nature saying, of course, in a sort of fabling way, as you rightly say, what did you ever think you were doing? Even Jim, if you just thought you were going to get on terms with your dad and be able to live with his story by having one of your own, it still involves a kind of greediness that is in of itself probably reprehensible. So there is a sense of sort of fabled punishment being handed out at the end, but I'm thinking very seriously at the moment about writing what happens next. And they survive, but they're in the middle of well, where are they? I mean, it's sort of where Mexico meets Texas
now.
Spanish America, of course, is what Stevenson calls it. And as you've reminded everybody, it's 1802. It's very early. What was happening there then is, frankly, not very much, except there are a lot of small Native American tribes living there. And I've been spending the last year or so reading about Native American tribes. And I've got very keen on the idea of trying to get them home through some experience of living with them for a bit, which would at least allow me to say some more about Jim's feelings about the natural world, which is just before the Westerners start murdering everything as well as everybody there.
This is a brilliant idea.
We'll see.
Oh, I think it's marvellous. I'm excited all over again. Andrew, when did you first read Treasure Island?
Well, I was very struck by what you said at the beginning, because I don't think that I did read it when I was a child, but like those people you were conjuring up, I sort of absorbed it by osmosis, literary osmosis. I mean, that's nothing against Stevenson, but it's simply because my parents were not readers. We just didn't read when I was a child. My mum read a little bit. My father, I remember looking at me rather balefully towards the end of his much longer than my mother's life and saying, I mean, he was clearly wondering how on earth he'd managed to have me. He was saying that he reckoned that he'd read half a book in his life, which was The Lonely Skier by Hammond Innes. Somebody must have told him it was a thriller. But obviously not very thrilling for him. Mm. So there weren't books around, or not books that anybody read anyway. And I don't think that I actually read it until I was at university, which was very early 1970s. And I can remember thinking immediately how stunningly good it was, but also how unfinished it was, knowingly unfinished it was in the ways that we've already talked about. And also how interesting it was that, whereas Joseph Conrad, a writer whose interests are so similar to Stevenson's in so many ways and whose time of writing overlaps with Stevenson's very interestingly, Conrad is firmly ensconced within the academy, but Stevenson isn't quite. I mean, general readers love him, and everybody thinks they read it or says they read it, Treasure Island, I mean. But actually, I think the Academy is rather suspicious of good stories, and they needn't be. Nothing wrong with them.
Well, everybody Joseph Conrad them. Is clearly literature.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's very literary. You're aware of it. You're aware of him turning a phrase in every single paragraph.
Indeed.
Where when Stevenson writes, you're just whisked along by the language is fabulous.
Well, it really is, I think. Yeah.
And you learn the word coracle.
You learn the word coracle, for instance. Yes, I mean, you're saying exactly the right thing about it, if I may say so. It seems to me that it does completely whiz along, and yet it is wonderfully well written. I mean, the page, for instance, on which Jim, the original Jim, shoots Israel Hands, what a name, as you say, and they're, as you remember, they're climbing up the mast of their boat, and Hands falls off, and he falls through the surface of the water, and he lands on the sandy bed of the anchorage. And Stevenson, just in a paragraph, describes how he seems to be moving because the water is rippling over him and the little fish are coming and going over him. It's a most brilliant piece of writing and wouldn't look out of place in, well, certainly wouldn't look out of place in Dickens, and actually wouldn't look out of place in Conrad either.
I reckon if we were going to set up a course, a university course, you could do Robinson Crusoe, which of course is written more than 100 years earlier, but was huge in the 19th century, bigger than it was in its own century.
That's right.
Gulliver's Travels, Treasure Island, King Solomon's Mines.
Yeah, that would be a very interesting little group of books, wouldn't it? And you could talk about them fascinatingly in and on their own terms. And then you'd say, and what do they turn into? And you very quickly start talking about Conrad. And then you start talking about Lord of the Flies, and so on and so on and so on. I mean, that's a very, very rich tradition of writing, which is essentially to do with the isolated self and how it copes with that and the pressures that come with that.
Andrew, I was wondering whether you'd written this book partly as an attempt to address the divide between literature and the popular tradition. You know, there was, when you and I were at university, when we were studying English, there was a feeling in English departments that people who read novels by people like Conrad were better than people who didn't, that the arts made you morally good. But in reality, the English departments of the world were filled with people who were actually a little bit strange.
Yes, and hardly seemed, knew how to behave at all.
Yes, and seemed ill at ease with the kind of people they met on the bus.
Quite so. Isn't that interesting? It's clearly a mistake for that reason and a million others that one might pull in under that heading to think that if you read a good book, it makes you a better person. It doesn't work like that. But I still think that if you read well, by which I partly mean carefully, but also in your imagination in a fully-fledged way, what happens is that you, and the book is good enough, what happens is that you're invited into a universe, a more or less self-contained, self-sufficient universe, in which you, the reader, are asked to make all kinds of moral decisions about what's happening there. It's very, and of course this happens in the theatre as well, if you think about Shakespeare and what Keats in particular has to say about Shakespeare. All Keats's ideas of how we hate poetry that has a palpable design on us, or axioms in philosophy are not axioms until they're proved upon our pulses. These are all ways of saying that Keats wants to write poems like Shakespeare writes plays, like good novelists write good novels, which is to say they never come to the front of the page and wave their finger at us and tell us what to think. They moralise us in that sense by requiring us to make those decisions. And in the process, they also encourage us, and this is the other aspect of linked aspect of good reading, I think, to see the world through other people's eyes, to stand in other people's shoes. So there should be, if that works well, and I believe this, that should mean that good books of any kind, of any genre, have an innately liberalizing effect because they encourage us to see the world through other people's eyes. So, as my own children would say, what's not to like about that?
So this is what Coleridge called the civilization of the community.
It's exactly what Coleridge meant by the civilization of the community. And, of course, the other thing that Coleridge means when he's talking about that is that we must pay attention to the various bodies, organizations, institutions, outfits that surround the reading of literature that are essentially looking in the same direction, which is towards how the humanities in general and their manifestation, their various manifestations, can enrich our lives as human beings. They are, in that sense, importantly what make us human.
Andrew Motion's novel Silver, Return to Treasure Island, is published by Jonathan Cape. But from the mid-18th century, we're about to move both back to the 15th century and forward to the 1940s in Sonia Hartnett's The Children of the King. Australian novelist Sonia Hartnett wasn't in London during the Blitz. She also hasn't been to the Tower of London, but like many writers, she's haunted by the tragic story of the princes in the Tower. The royal princes, sons of Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville, who were imprisoned and then disappeared, presumably murdered. But in an imaginative twist, she intertwines this story of children whose lives are at the mercy of royal power, politics and conflict, with the story of children who were evacuated from London during World War II. Cecily, Jeremy and May have been tossed from their normal lives, as were so many others. Sonia Hartnett is sharp and unsentimental about her characters in this book, Children of the King, and she can be very funny about her writing processes too. Here she is with Michael Cathcart and the 1940s context for Cecily and Jeremy Lockwood.
They've gone to stay at the grand house of their uncle and brother-in-law, Peregrine, and along the way they pick up a evacuee, May, and when they get to the house, May makes the discovery in the ruins that are on the land that two boys are hiding out in the ruins, and it basically goes on from there.
May Bright, her May name, Bright. Aged 10. She's from the lower class.
She is. Her father was a teacher and her mother was a housewife but has now joined the war effort in London. But, yeah, she was actually meant to be the main character, but as the book went along, it was one of those books that tended to write itself a bit, and as it went along, Cecily became the main character more than May.
Well, she's got a great character arc because she starts as a snobby little princess, basically.
Yeah, she's... I mean, it's always great to write a children's novel in that you can have real fun with the characters, I've found. And one way to do that is to have a character who, because they are a child, they can get away with a lot of things that perhaps an adult character couldn't get away with. And Cecily is one of those children that as you're writing her, you just go, oh, you're outrageous. But she's a spoilt child, but she's also a good-hearted child.
So the girls go off on a ramble, basically, into the countryside. They come to a castle and they meet these two boys and suddenly the whole story opens up.
Yeah, it takes a very different path from then on, although it veers back and forth a little bit, but it links into the story of Richard III. a story that I've always been interested in.
Richard III as we know him through Shakespeare, or just Richard III as the king who murdered the princes?
Just Richard. I mean, I think you have to dismiss everything that Shakespeare told us about Richard III. I mean, Shakespeare had his reasons for presenting Richard the way he did and has done a great deal of damage to Richard III, if it's possible to do the damage, to do any damage to the reputation of somebody who snuffed out two young children. But Richard was a man of his time, and I think we don't give him credit for that, or at least we don't take that into account as much as we should.
Mm. Let's explain to the listener then how the story of Richard III and the princess that he killed feeds into this story about two children having a ripping time in a castle.
When May discovers the ruins of Snow Castle on Peregrine's land, she asks him about it, and because the children aren't being sent to school in the village that they've come to, Peregrine tells them the story of Snow Castle's connection to Richard III.
I mean, it really strikes me that you've been able to use all the resources that English writers have at their disposal, that you can have a castle which is steeped in European history that goes way, way back, a resource that's very hard to access when you're setting a story in Australia.
Yeah, look, I recently had to answer a few questions about, did you go to Yorkshire for this, for the research of this book? Have you been to the Tower of London? All of which is like, no, no, no. I mean, I guess I've been writing novels for a long, long time, and you work out what you need to know. Particularly when you're writing a children's novel, you don't need a great deal of detail. So all my research was just done basically from TV documentaries,
right,
and books, things like that.
I'm talking to Sonia Hartnett because she's written a lovely new book called The Children of the King, which has been packaged up really in the full, child storybook kind of mode. It is like an English storybook. It's a beautiful hardback book with lovely illustrations at the start of every chapter, beautiful little pictures, even beautiful end papers.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm always interested in the design of the books. And we got an English illustrator to do the book for us, which was nice and interesting, and he was very good and efficient at it. He's just started to do children's books, so that's always nice as well.
Mm. I mean, it's not, you've got a reputation for writing stories that are bleak and realistic in a sort of gritty way. This is a joyful story.
Yeah, look, perhaps I'm going a little soft in my age, but it's also a story about two young children who get murdered by their uncle, don't forget.
Well, that's true.
That's
true.
I sort of defend my reputation as being a writer of grim fiction. I think that my books, although they are sometimes quite hard-edged, also show people doing the very best that they can under difficult circumstances. People ask me all the time, is it easier to write for children or for adults? And it's absolutely easier to write for adults than it is for children. Children, especially when you're writing something harsh like children being murdered by their uncle, it requires a lot of ability to write that sort of stuff for children and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
It took me years and years and years, I reckon 20 years of writing for adults before I thought I had the skill to write for children.
And in this story, as so often, it's the kids who are in touch with the real world. You know, the adults spend a lot of time sort of tut-tutting and swapping platitudes about the war, but the kids are the ones who are really where the action is.
Well, I think that's a great tradition of children's books, that you put the children in the middle of the action, and it's the children who bear the responsibility of the outcome of their adventure or the story or whatever. But also, I like to think, I always put my children in places where, the adults were running the war and the adults are running the world, basically. And if one thing I remember from childhood, it was a sense of complete lack of knowledge of or understanding of how the world operated.
Mm.
And I think to be a child during the war must have been a huge, how could a child process what the war was? That book has been, I read a review the other day that said, these children, the war doesn't touch them in a way. Maybe Hartnett should have made the war touch them a bit more. But you go, well, children would have been protected to some degree, especially wealthy children like these. And maybe for them the war was quite a distant, dreamy thing. They wouldn't have had any real understanding of it, so
I'm sure it was. If you're not seeing the war around you, it's something you hear about but can't make sense of.
Exactly.
Now, you've been talking about writing for children, And I want to quote something that you said to The Guardian back in 2008. You said, "I do not really write for children. I only write for me and for the few people I hope to please when I write a story." Were you just in the mood the day you said that? Were you spiky? Or
No, it remains true. I mean, I think when you're sitting in your bedroom, as I do, with your laptop on a shaky plastic table and your animals crowding off your bed, it's certainly impossible for me to think of an audience. But as I type out each word, I think I'm aware of who's going to be reading the manuscript very first and thinking, are they going to go, "Oh, that's bad," or "Yes, nicely done," or something. So you're only thinking of the very closest, most critical of readers. And when I write, I guess in many ways I'm performing for those people. I'm saying, this is what I've learnt, this is what you've taught me, this is what I can do. Is it good enough to please you? You can't think of a mass of faceless children or adults out there. You just can't. I can't invite them into my bedroom with me. I have to think of one person.
Are you doing the thing in life which you choose to be doing, or has life somehow brought you to this point?
The older I get, the less sure I feel about my abilities to talk about the books, or even, it becomes less comfortable for me as the years go by, because I just think, what am I doing here? I am the biggest fraud. I did not really want to be a writer. I said before that Enid Blyton made me want to be a writer, but what Enid Blyton made me want was to have an object that looked like that with my name on it. That's what I wanted. I didn't actually want to be somebody who sat down and composed stories. But it has become my life, and I guess about 5 years ago I bowed down to the inevitable and decided that it would be. That is what I do. People ask me all the time, how many have you written? I have no idea. And some of them I completely forget the writing of and everything. Yeah. I don't know if it's just because Alzheimer's has struck me early I guess the older I get and the more I write, the more sure I am that there's like a part of me that writes the books and there's another part of me, and these two parts are strangers. When I was young and used to write books, you'd get very involved in the characters and feel them as very much real people and everything. Now they're just tools to me. They are that I create them to do a job, and when the job is done, the tools are laid down and I don't look back. So, yeah, it's a kind of heartless way of approaching what is something that people actually take very much to heart, because people love the books that they love. I mean, they love them passionately. But to me, and they expect that sort of passion from me as well. But I had that passion in my youth, but now this is a job to me. And like I say, I want to do it well, but I don't love the characters or anything. I'm grateful to them when they behave, and I'm grateful to them when a character like Cecily takes the book and runs with it. But apart from that, they're just a job.
Sonia Hartnett's Children of the King is published by Viking. And while those princes in the tower were real children, the next boy in our show is entirely made up. And yet, how many times, how many places he has appeared. Peter Pan.
Imagine a world where every day is an adventure.
Where are we going?
The Neverland. Oh,
Peter, it would be so wonderful.
You must make yourself remember.
Remember what?
Peter, don't you know who you are?
I'll never grow up, never grow up, not me.
The boy who never grew up has become so much a part of our cultural fabric and popular culture that it's hard to imagine a time without him. But Scottish writer J.M. Barrie first published the novel Peter and Wendy in 1911, although the character had appeared in another of his books in 1902. And Peter Pan has had so many different lives that Harvard folklorist Maria Tatar has been tracking them and has edited a new annotated Peter Pan. So here she is, speaking with Michael Cathcart and remembering her first encounter with the boy.
My first memory is a disappointing one, because I experienced Peter Pan on the television screen. I watched it as a six-year-old, and Peter Pan was played by a woman, by Mary Martin. It took me a while to get over that, and I did fall in love with Disney's Peter Pan. In animation, you can do things that you can't do on the stage. Everyone can fly over London and soar through the air without any strings at all. Now, of course, there are politically incorrect moments in that film. The song, What Makes the Red Man Red, makes you cringe today, but there are wonderful moments in the film.
What about the statue of Peter Pan in London's Kensington Gardens? Does that have a role in your story?
That was my second important encounter with Peter Pan, walking through the gardens and following the tourists. I didn't know where the statue was, but I just followed clusters of tourists. And I will never forget that moment when I had not yet seen the statue. It wasn't visible, but I could hear the voices. It was like a symphony of these voices, breathlessly saying, Peter Pan. And there was such reverence and awe from, you know, tourists the world over. These were not just locals, but we were united at that statue in our love for Peter Pan.
It's a little and very intimate statue, isn't it?
You can't get close to Peter Pan. And one of Peter Pan's characteristic features, this is in the stage directions for the 1907 play, he cannot be touched by anyone. And I love that sentence because it, touch in the physical sense, but also he's the boy who cannot grow up. And no one can move him emotionally, no matter how hard they try. No matter how much those girls flirt with him, he does not fall for them. So as much as we all adore him and worship him, and there is a cult of Peter Pan, as I've discovered almost everywhere, it's a kind of ubiquitous cult, he also keeps a distance. We have to keep our distance from him as well.
I wonder whether people are in love with Peter Pan or whether they're in love with the Peter Pan in themselves.
Oh, with the notion of keeping the child within a lot. Of course, we're all former children. We all remember what it was like to fall under the spell of fairy dust and to be able to fly and to go to places like Neverland and experience what Barry called ecstasies innumerable.
Mm. How did it all begin, the story, I mean?
I didn't get that.
How did the story start? When did Barry first come up with the idea for this character?
Well, what's wonderful about this story is that it had its origins in play with children. That is, it is a kind of collaboration between Barry and the five Llewellyn Davies boys. They summered, the Llewellyn Davies family and Barry and his wife summered, and Barry had just finished writing a play. He had some time on his hands. He wanted to take a break. And what did he do? He created a script for the boys, Pirate Games, and Barry provided not only the script but also the props. Including his dog, who played a role, and he himself was Captain Swarthy. Barry also had a camera that summer, and he took pictures of the boys at play, and he created this wonderful book of photographs, which is a kind of dress rehearsal for Peter Pan. And it was called The Boy Castaways of Black Lake Island. And that's what morphed eventually, what evolved into the play Peter Pan. It went through many different inflections. We have not only a play, but also a novel. Barry wrote a screenplay of Peter Pan as well. Paramount rejected it and ended up using their own screenplay. But he exists, this boy who would not grow up, exists in many different versions.
One of the details I found really fascinating in your book is the way you explain that the stage play went through many manifestations and that really this is a very malleable story for Barry, and perhaps there was even some reluctance to pin the details down in the way a novel must.
That's right, and he's a boy who can't be pinned down in a way. So the play was actually not published until 1928, some 21 years after its first performance. It was constantly changing. Barry was writing new scenes at the last moment. And then there were certain scenes that were cut. One had the mothers who were coming to claim the lost boys. And so it went through many different iterations.
When you say the mothers coming to claim the lost boys, it was a version in which there was a whole football team of mothers appeared on stage.
And it was quite what I think Barry loved, the idea of being able to cast all of these beautiful young women, bring them on stage. But it was also a fairly costly enterprise. And I think for practical reasons, they were eliminated at a certain point.
So as we're discussing, the story is very changeable. Are there some constant elements? I mean, if I were to ask you to give us a brief outline of the core story, could you do that for us?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is home. We begin at home with the nuclear family, with a bumbling father, Mr. Darling, who never seems to do anything right, Mrs. Darling, who is tender and loving, and then suddenly adventure in the form of fairy dust. Every child's fantasy is to be able to fly away, to go off to adventures, and the children land on the island, this wonderful island that has crocodiles and mermaids and rainbows. It's a place of exquisite beauty. And it's also, as Barry tells us, it's everything that is in the mind of a child. It's pure imagination. And it's there that Peter leads them through a series of adventures, but also Wendy creates a new home in Neverland. She's always sewing and darning and fussing and taking over the role of mother, which is why some critics worry about gender trouble in Neverland. But they fight the pirates, they defeat Hook, and return, they decide that they want to go back home. And Peter is tempted to go back with them. But he decides that he will not grow up. And there's a wonderfully poignant scene that is written to end the play, showing how Wendy has grown up and is with her daughter, and Peter returns to take her daughter for spring cleaning. So every child gets to experience the magic and fantasy of Peter Pan.
Let's dig a bit deeper into who Peter Pan is. I guess, you know, we could see him as coming out of some kind of collective unconscious, you know, speaking to some desire in us all. We could link him to some kind of mythological ancestry, could we?
Oh, absolutely. I think the wonderful thing about Peter Pan is that he incorporates bits and pieces of mythology. You could also link him to Barry's brother, David, the boy who could not grow up, because he died in an ice skating accident. But there's also Pan, the god Pan. There's also even Peter, the name Peter has certain biblical connotations. So Barry just used everything that he could find to create this composite figure, to invent something completely new, a new mythology, really, which is quite extraordinary, quite an accomplishment.
Your book really alerted me to the way in which Peter, in some ways, is immoral, even a narcissist.
Oh, absolutely. He does not know good and evil. And he is, you know, there's this wonderful pop psychologist who has written a book about the Peter Pan syndrome, about sort of narcissistic males who are totally irresponsible and carefree and cannot connect or commit. So Peter Pan is very much, he's a creature who does not have connections. He has lost his mother. He goes back at one point. He decides to go back home, and he finds that the window is barred, and his mother has a new child. And I think it's at that moment that he decides to live completely for himself and to be the leader of the Lost Boys.
So Neverland's an interesting place itself. I mean, in one way, it's a sort of moral contest because we think that the pirates are baddies, and we, you know, we want to side with the Lost Boys. And in some ways the moral contest is very real because people actually die in the fighting.
They do. When you start to read this closely, as I did, you worry about those pirates who are killed in the final contest. And then, of course, Wendy is shot with an arrow, which turns out to be just a play arrow. So somehow, in Neverland, there's a kind of immunity for the children. Nothing happens to them. But the pirates, of course, bite the dust again and again. But this is all done. Barry manages to pull this off in a way that is not terrifying, but rather cathartic in a way. And the deaths are all grotesque and comical rather than tragic and serious. So, again, Neverland is a land of make-believe. You know that you are going to be able to return home from it, and you'll be safe there. That's what's so beautiful about it.
But it's not a utopia. It's a place of adventures and danger from which you can go back, actually, to the utopia of the nursery.
Oh, exactly, to the safety of the nursery. Mm. But you get to act everything out in Neverland. And children have an appetite, a hunger, a deep need for the kinds of adventures that the children have in Neverland. And they fight those battles by proxy.
One of the scenes that really stayed with me when I was a little boy was the scene where Peter loses his shadow. And what happens? Wendy sews it back or tries to sew it back on for him. I never knew what it meant, but it seemed to me to be quite important. And I can remember trying to escape from my own shadow when I was 5 years old. And, of course, I couldn't do it.
Well, you pointed to an extraordinary moment because, remember, Peter is dressed in skeleton leaves. And what does he leave in the nursery but his shadow? And oddly, although this is a book about adventures and all of these marvelous things, there is also the shadow of death lurking there. And, of course, we know there is Hook in Neverland being pursued by a crocodile. And what does the crocodile have inside but a clock ticking away, reminding us that we will all grow up one day and we will all die. Peter Pan may be safe. Actually, even he can be killed, but he won't grow up, but the rest of us will. So I see.
So the crocodile with the clock in its tummy is time's winged chariot hurrying near.
Absolutely. And so the story is sort of haunted by anxieties about death in ways that we don't expect a book for children to be.
No, that's right. What about a Freudian reading? Could we try one of those? I mean, we've got Peter and Wendy on one side, I guess, and then we've got Hook and Mr. Darling as, well, sort of rival father figures, really.
Oh, well, yes. And in many of the play versions, Mr. Darling and Hook are played by the same character. So you have the bumbling, slightly silly father at home, Mr. Darling, and then, what could we call him, an Oedipal father? I feel so uncomfortable taking on a Freudian reading because somehow I think that does, it breaks the magic spell in ways that I'm uncomfortable with.
Yes, it makes it instructive in some way, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's true that it is the age of Freud, and Barry must certainly have been aware of the Viennese witch doctor, as Nabokov called him. But I don't, you know, one could talk about the id in this play and all of that, but somehow I find myself always going back to the power of the story and of the characters and these wonderful adventures they have.
On Books and Arts Daily, I'm talking to Professor Maria Tata, who's put together a lovely edition of the story of Peter Pan. Maria, I once saw a brilliant student production of Peter Pan in which Peter was played by a paunchy middle-aged man who kept, you know, leaping around in tights saying, I want to be a boy, I want to stay young forever. And that interpretation of the play made it very unsettling. It suggested that the dream of eternal youth was actually quite deluded.
Oh, yes. And, you know, if you look at Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch, you start to worry about the Peter Pan syndrome, that is, thinking that you can go back. And the fact of the matter is we can go back when we read Peter and Wendy with our children or when we go to the play, but in reality, we should not try to recapture that. You know, Michael Jackson famously said, "I am Peter Pan." And there's a certain tragedy in that. Barry himself knew that he suffered from this same syndrome. He wanted to keep playing marbles into old age. He dreaded the thought of growing up. And it was when he adopted the five orphaned Llewellyn Davies boys that he finally made the decision to grow up, to take on these responsibilities.
Yeah, we should explain that those five boys that he went away on a holiday with, as you were telling us at the start of our conversation, subsequently were orphaned, their parents were killed, and he adopted them. It is possible to see Barry as a slightly creepy figure with this fixation with young children. You don't seem like that.
I think that what he did was a great good thing. He adopted these five orphan boys. He was wonderfully generous with them. He loved the boys, and I haven't tried to fathom the mysteries of exactly what that love is. What I do know from working through 19 linear feet of archival material at the Beinecke Library in New Haven at Yale University, where Barry's papers are, is that there's not a shred of evidence that there was anything inappropriate in his relationship with the boys. So somehow I think that, I don't think I'm being overly reverent about Barry. I think that if you just read the story, you look at the correspondence between Barry and the boys, you hear what they had to say. There were ups and downs in their relationships, to be sure. They had to do mainly with financial matters. Peter Davies was quite upset by the fact that Barry had not been generous enough with him in his will. But these were the ordinary kinds of squabbles that would come up in any family.
We've talked about the stage versions. We've talked about the book, the well-known book. We've talked briefly about the Disney cartoon of 1953. Another take on this is Spielberg's movie Hook from 1991, starring Dustin Hoffman as a very toothsome hook and Robin Williams as Peter, who's grown up and forgotten about his Neverland past. Now he's a lawyer with children of his own, but Hook wants one last battle with Peter, and so he's drawn back and he has to remember who he is. What's your take on that film?
Oh, I love the fact that Peter, in that case, has become a pirate. He's a corporate lawyer. And the moment, there's this exquisite moment in the film when, as you point out, he suddenly remembers that he's Peter Pan. And the way he does it is to get down to the level of the boys. He goes down on his knees. He takes off his glasses. He gives himself a little facelift. He smiles. And suddenly he breaks out into laughter, and he remembers what was to be a child. And that's just a spectacular moment in the film for adults and children alike.
Maria Tatar is Professor of Germanic Languages and Literatures, Folklore and Mythology at Harvard University. Her annotated Peter Pan is published by W.W. Norton & Co., and clap your hands if you believe in book reading, children. And that's it for the first hour of Books Plus. I'm Kate Evans, and there are more details of all our guests and their books on our website at abc.net.au/radionational. And there are more and more books still to come.
Hello, Wendy Harmer here. I had a great time presenting Life Matters this past week. One of my favourite stories was my chat with Candy Baker on the wisdom of women. If you missed that one or any other program this week, you can listen online anytime or podcast us from abc.net.au/radionational. Follow the links to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell will be back next week after 9 here on RN.